Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We are expecting a continuation of pretty much what we've seen the last several days, and that is near or above normal temperatures and near or above normal rainfall across virtually the entire country. And the only place that might experience slightly below normal temperatures would be in the vicinity of the Great Lakes. Just about everybody else expected to remain warm or hot. Greatest likelihood of those hotter than normal conditions will be across the deep south and also in the northwest and northern high plains.
Extended weather outlook with Brad Rippey of USDA.
Now, in terms of the rainfall forecast, the greater likelihood of wet weather compared to normal will be focused across the southwest, which means an active monsoon circulation will continue, and also across the southeast, also a somewhat greater likelihood than other areas of experiencing wetter than normal conditions.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The U.S. and Vietnam finalizing a new trade agreement with implications that could reach several sectors of U.S. ag, including cotton. While details of the deal are still being reviewed, early analysis suggests that increased market access for U.S. commodities, in particular cotton and soybeans, may follow. Vietnam, already a leading importer of American cotton, where it fuels the country's robust textile manufacturing industry. Any tariff reductions or regulatory streamlining under the agreement could help U.S. cotton remain competitive against global suppliers like Brazil and India. But for now, ag leaders watching closely for guidance on implementation timelines and any potential changes to trade flows heading into the harvest season. USDA continuing to distribute funding under the American Relief Act, providing $30.78 billion for ag producers. Now, of that total, $10 billion allocated for economic relief, another $20.78 billion allocated for natural disaster assistance. Sign-up currently open for the Emergency Commodity Assistance Program, or ECAP, which began accepting applications on March 19th. It will close August 15th. ECAP is the economic assistance portion of the package, includes initial payments factored at 85% to stay within the funding cap. If funding remains after the August deadline, a second round of payments may follow. On the disaster side, USDA actively issuing Emergency Livestock Relief Program payments, or ELRP. Roughly $1 billion in these funds released at the end of May to livestock producers affected by recent weather events. Attention now shifts to the new Supplemental Disaster Relief Program, or SDRP. It's the next generation version of past programs like WIP, WIP Plus, ERP, and is designed to support producers with losses incurred in 2023 and 2024 due to drought, hurricanes, wildfires, flooding, freeze event, excessive heat, and other similar events. USDA is targeting July 7th for sign-up to begin. Agency says initial enrollment will focus on indemnified losses, such as insured crops, while sign-up for shallow or uninsured losses scheduled to begin September 15th. Now, it is important to note that while $20.78 billion reserved for disaster aid, other obligations like ELRP and hurricane relief block grants means the actual amount available will be lower. USDA is expected to apply a flat payment factor to adjust the total claims to available funds, although the specific figure has not yet been announced. And the latest USDA cotton system consumption and stocks report shows a continued increase in man-made fiber use alongside declines in active cotton spindles. Now, in May, total man-made fiber consumption on the cotton system reached 20 million pounds. It's up 1% from April, but up 40% from the same period a year ago. And polyester representing 93% of that total. The data reflects broader trends in the textile sector, where blended and synthetic fibers continue to gain market share, while declining market share for natural cotton. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In 2022, USDA launched the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program, or CSC, which provided funding and technical assistance directly to farmers to help them scale climate-friendly practices like cover cropping, tillage management, and prescribed grazing, to name a few.
Ranking member of the House Ag Subcommittee on Conservation, Research, and Biotechnology, Jill Takuda from Hawaii, with Nicole Galassi of the Hawaii Cattlemen's Association.
This program was overwhelmingly popular, and food producers across the country leveraged $3.1 billion in CSC funding to get shovels in the ground on cost-effective, partnership-based conservation projects. That was until April, when USDA abruptly canceled the program, claiming that CSC projects didn't prioritize direct payments to farmers. But in reality, farmers were receiving direct financial and technical support, often exceeding the arbitrary 65% threshold for direct payments, including in the administration's new Farmers First priorities. Now, more than 14,000 farmers covering 3.2 million acres across the country are left wondering what will happen to their planned conservation work, in some cases already investments made. There's nothing Farmer First about yanking the rug out from under these farmers, if you ask me. And the USDA, we know, has promised to replace CSC with the Advancing Markets for Producers Initiative, or AMP. But it's unclear when project reapplications will, in fact, be reviewed, how much funding will be available, and what farmers who are planning on this funding are supposed to do with the work that's already ongoing. Ms. Galassi, in your written testimony, you mentioned that you are eager to apply for AMP to continue projects started already and invested in under CSC, and you are currently in conversations with the USDA about this reapplication. What impact has frozen CSC funds had on planned conservation work and on your producers? What has been the impact on them, given many have already made investments in the ground?
Thank you for highlighting this issue. We did see the Climate Smart Commodities Program as something that was going to help our producers. We had funds going directly to farmers, ranchers, and foresters. Because it was canceled, those projects are canceled as well. All those contracts were canceled. And if a producer is extremely fortunate, they're going to be continuing those projects on their own dime. But that was not planned for. And as you know, in agriculture, you need to plan for years ahead. We went through the hard work of getting them through the arduous onboarding process, and we had those funds on the ground. Producers were starting the work. Now they're essentially finished, and they don't know when they're going to get the funding back. And the producer engagement teams, such as the Hawaii Cattlemen's Council, who are helping with that difficult onboarding, a lot of the other organizations have lost dozens of employees who are now unemployed. And in looking at applying for the next Advancing Markets for Producers initiative, we're now applying with a very bare bones team.
But when it comes to technology, Russell Baining, a producer from Texas, adds,
I got to thinking here when you went down that road, how much has changed in my 43-year farming career. And things just simply like GPS has enabled us to move to things like minimum tillage and nutrient management, and those are all conservation efforts as well. When you think about fertilization application rates that you can tailor as you go across your field and apply them at variable rates to because then there is no excess. You don't overuse it. You don't underuse it. So precision ag has been, it's been a good thing.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Mr. Secretary, I think I'm like most Americans. I agree with some of the things that you and the White House have done on tariffs, disagree with others.
Louisiana Senator John Kennedy at a recent Appropriations Committee hearing with Howard Lutnick, Commerce Secretary.
It's clear to me that the President listens to your advice about tariffs, so I want to spend my precious time trying to understand how you think. If Vietnam, for example, came to you tomorrow and said, okay, Mr. Secretary, you win. We're going to remove all tariffs and all trade barriers. Would the United States please do the same? Would you accept that deal?
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. That would be the silliest thing we could do.
Why is that?
Vietnam has a $125 billion exports to us and imports from us $12.5 million. And you're thinking, Vietnam exports $125 billion?
I'm aware of the figures, but tell
me. But where do they get it from? They buy $90 billion from China, then they mark it up and send it to us.
So you
would just a pathway of China to us.
You wouldn't accept that deal.
No, it's a terrible deal. We're the one with money. We're the one with the store. Of course they want us to take
down. What's the purpose of reciprocity then? Is reciprocity not one of your goals? Are you telling the president that we shouldn't seek reciprocity? If that's what you're telling him, why are you trying to do these trade deals?
What do we want? We want to encourage Vietnam to produce products they're great at producing.
But I want to get back to reciprocity. You just said you don't believe in, you don't accept reciprocity as a goal. What are you negotiating in these trade deals?
Why would we open our bank account and their bank account when ours is 10 times bigger?
Why are you negotiating trade deals? You're trying to get other countries to lower their tariffs and trade barriers in return for us lowering ours.
That's true for the things that they'll take from us.
That's called reciprocity.
Of course.
So are you not seeking reciprocity in these trade deals?
We are absolutely seeking reciprocity with respect to things that can be reciprocal.
But you just said,
but when they're imported from China and sending it to us,
you just said that if a country came to you and offered you the ultimate reciprocity, no tariffs, no trade barriers, in return for us doing the same, you would reject that.
Of course, because they buy from China and send it to us. Don't you agree with me?
Suppose they said we won't buy from China.
Now we're talking. Would
you accept that deal?
We would consider it. For what things? For
what
products?
What would you want to change?
Well, there are certain products we want to reshore. We don't want other people making them. We want to make pharmaceuticals here.
Right.
We need to protect ourselves
for
certain things.
Let me ask you this because I'm going to run out of time. Are trade deficits, are you advising the president that trade deficits are always bad in every situation?
No.
Okay. When are trade deficits good?
Trade deficits, for instance, let's say there was a company that had the cure for cancer. Let's call it cancer cure. And we were buying it and it was located in another country. We would obviously have a trade deficit with them because they have the only one of it. An example, our technology companies, our great technology companies, we're the only ones with it.
So a trade deficit is okay if they're products we really need.
If they're the only ones with it and we can't do it, then of course it's fine. But if we can do it, then we darn well better think about whether we're supposed to do it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You know, the One Big Beautiful Bill provided key investments for farmers and ranchers.
At a recent House Ag Subcommittee hearing on conservation research and biotech, G.T. Thompson, chairman of the committee from Pennsylvania.
This included necessary updates to the Farm Safety Net, investments in livestock security measures, research, and trade promotion. It also rescinded unobligated IRA conservation funds and reinvested those dollars into the standing conservation programs. By doing so, we will have eliminated the climate sideboards and returned the funding to meet an important core principle, locally led conservation that benefits all farmers.
Thompson with a question for Russell Boehning, President, Texas Farm Bureau.
How important are these investments for our agriculture producers?
The simple answer there, Mr. Chairman, is of the utmost importance. Those, you know, we've talked about all morning here. These programs were successful, and Chairman Lucas mentioned it in his opening statements, because they're flexible, they're voluntary, and they're locally led. So those programs are what farmers have worked with and benefited from over the years. So, you know, quite frankly, and it's not just the farming and the ag community that benefit from it. It's our rural communities. It's all of those things so those investments are of the utmost importance to farmers and ranchers.
So isn't it true that in addition to just the fact that American agriculture can be defined as science, technology, and innovation, that coupled with this type of investment, and these programs really help to contribute to the fact that our farmers, ranchers, and foresters are climate champions of the the world, you know, with the amount of carbon they sequester. And the beauty of it in agriculture, when we sequester carbon, we manufacture topsoil, which means we grow things for the benefit of everyone.
Yes, sir.
The Inflation Reduction Act required that funding provided by the law for conservation programs could only be used for climate-related practices, thereby restricting funding for many other practices otherwise eligible under the program. And some very credible individuals, including the NRCS chief during President Obama's administration, for one, have said it would be best if the sideboards were taken out so that the state technical committees and local groups can decide which practices work best for the natural resource concerns that they wish to address. Through the current reconciliation process, we are trying to reinvest those IRA unobligated conservation funding, as we've talked about in this hearing already, into the existing conservation programs to provide a permanent increase to the title's baseline. In doing so, we'd also remove those climate sideboards required by the IRA to allow for more local prioritization. I'll just open this up to all of our panelists. Do you agree that reducing or removing the climate sideboards would better allow it to be locally led process to be able to work and be able to use conservation practices that, you know, that may vary depending on, you know, where in the country the farmer is actually farming? I can think of many places where cover crops, if you put a cover crop in, it would suck every last bit of moisture out of the ground, and you wouldn't be able to grow a cash crop. And some places where a cover crop, it gets too cold too soon to be able to do planting like that. So I'll just open it up for anybody who would like to comment on that question.
I'll just go really quickly, sir. By opening it up, removing those sideboards, it goes back to the same things we've been talking about, being flexible, being locally led, and it's still voluntary. The climate smart practices will still be eligible. So it goes back to the core of how these programs work the best.
It's Agriculture Today. Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Last month, we removed layers of red tape that undermined coal production on federal lands.
Interior Secretary Doug Burgum telling a House Appropriations Subcommittee about work by his department.
Clean American coal is a triple win for our country because thermal coal provides reliable and affordable baseload electricity at a time when we need more electricity than ever. Metallurgical coal is the foundation for bringing back our steel industry, which we need for national security. And the mining and refining of coal that contains critical and rare earth minerals is essential to secure our own domestic supply chain for our defense, transportation, and tech industries, because today we are in a huge position of vulnerability relative to our critical mineral supply chain. Right now, America is in an artificial intelligence arms race with China. This race is going to be won not only by technology, but by electricity production. Keeping domestic coal-fired power generation open will help us win this contest while driving down electricity costs for American families and improving the reliability of our grid. The department is also undertaking efforts to establish our position as the leading producer and processor of critical and rare earth minerals, which will create jobs and prosperity at home, strengthen domestic supply chains for the United States and its allies, increase our national security, and reduce the global influence of adversarial states. Preventing and combating wildfires is vitally important to protect people, communities, and the environment. Nearly 65,000 wildfires burned more than 8.9 million acres across the United States last year, endangering communities, critical infrastructure, and local economies. Federal wildlife risk mitigation and suppression responsibilities for wildlife fire, as this committee knows, is currently split across five agencies in two different departments. We've got duplicative and ineffective structures that couldn't be improved. This budget proposes reforming the federal wildland fire management to create an operational efficiencies by consolidating and unifying federal wildland fire responsibilities into a new centralized federal wildland fire service at the Department of Interior. This new service will streamline federal wildfire suppression response, risk mitigation efforts, and coordinate with non-federal partners, including states, locales, and tribes, to combat the wildfire crisis. The Department of Interior upholds the federal government's unique trust responsibility by fostering government-to-government relations between the federal government and federally recognized tribes, American Indians, and Alaska Natives. This budget supports programs at the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Bureau of Indian Education, sustaining the federal government support of the core programs that benefit tribal communities. Since becoming Interior Secretary, I've had the opportunity to travel to our national parks, historic sites, Bureau of Land Management, and Bureau of Reclamation, some incredible locations, including the Hoover Dam. Bureau of Reclamation is the number two hydropower producer in America. And I've also visited the wildlife refuges to learn and hear more from the leadership on the ground at each of these places. We're instituting changes to get more people actually working on the front lines, and we're looking forward to an outstanding summer at our historic sites, parks, and refuges. By opening more areas to hunting and outdoor recreation, we're helping to drive tourism, create jobs, and generate revenue for local communities, all while promoting responsible stewardship of our natural resources. Interior is also focused on streamlining our core business operations, which will result in significantly improved efficiencies and lower costs for Americans and will benefit each of the bureaus within Interior. This budget is about putting America first and doing the best for American taxpayer. As Interior moves forward, these initiatives set the foundation for renewed focus on responsible resource management and economic growth.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Medicaid and food stamps are the two largest means-tested programs, and they're both in need of reform.
At a recent House Budget Committee hearing, Matthew Dickerson with the Economic Policy Innovation Center.
My remarks today are going to focus on shortcomings in the food stamp program. In recent decades, enrollment has expanded significantly, benefit levels have grown faster than inflation, and taxpayer spending has surged. The program's work requirements are weak, limited, and often waived. Because of this, few of the millions of work-capable adults on the food stamp rolls work at all. More than 42 million Americans receive food stamps today, 3 million more than did so in 2020 during the pandemic. Since the year 2000, enrollment has grown 245%. Some enrollees do not even meet the statutory income and asset requirements. Meanwhile, spending on the food stamp program has exploded. The program is expected to cost $110 billion this year. In the last 25 years, annual spending has grown 645%. President Biden's policies increased food stamp spending by 54%, meaning the baseline for food stamps is now $394 billion higher over the next decade than originally projected. USDA admits the food stamp program makes billions of improper payments each year. The reported improper payment rate in 2023 was 11.7%. But we know that improper payments are actually much higher. The 2014 Farm Bill literally instructs USDA to ignore improper payments up to a quality control tolerance threshold. This year, improper payments below $57 per transaction are simply not reported. That's completely egregious and would get any small business in jail, owner in trouble for ignoring waste, fraud, and abuse. Because states are administering a program that is completely funded by the federal government, they have little incentive to control overpayments. As a result, many states have shockingly large overpayment rates. Introducing a state matching requirement whereby state governments would bear a portion of the program costs would certainly help this problem by giving states skin in the game. The One Big Beautiful Bill's cost-sharing requirement that's based on improper payment rates would not reduce or change total benefit spending on food stamps. But it would promote better outcomes for beneficiaries, it would promote fairness and fiscal federalism. The One Big Beautiful Bill would also make significant progress in promoting opportunity over dependency by restricting loopholes and enforcing work requirements. While 13 million able-bodied adults received benefits in 2022, fewer than 3.6 million able-bodied adults without dependents were supposed to be subject to work requirements. But many of these work-capable individuals could receive welfare benefits without working due to geographic waivers and no-good cause exemptions. Because of the loopholes, 84% of those who were supposed to be subject to the work requirement did not work the 20 hours per week. There is an inherent dignity in honest work. Work is not a punishment, but instead it provides an important source of purpose for people. It's demeaning to believe that many Americans are simply unable to be successful and should be relegated to a life of dependency on perpetual government subsidization of their basic needs. Instead, we should enact policies that empower people to earn success based on the belief that poverty and dependency can be temporary conditions. The best welfare benefit is one that gets a person off of welfare and back into work. The reforms included in the One Big Beautiful Bill represent important progress in addressing waste, fraud, and abuse, and eliminating these loopholes would restore food stamp program integrity while safeguarding assistance for the truly needy.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
A visit last month in Texas near the Mexico border by Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins featured an announced plan to combat and eradicate the new world screwworm threat to our country and our nation's livestock. That included collaborative efforts with Mexico.
In person, our own USDA team on the ground in Mexico, alongside and reviewing and analyzing and helping with their controls and continuing to aggressively engage.
And earlier this week, the Secretary announced risk-based port reopenings for cattle, bison, and equine imports from Mexico. The first such reopening is scheduled for as early as July 7th at the Douglas, Arizona port facility. Evaluation by USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service and Mexican counterparts after each reopening will precede scheduled, systematic reopening of other ports in New Mexico and Texas over the next several weeks. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.